Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network, as well as the Progressive Voices Network. You can also find us on iTunes. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And on today's episode, we're commemorating the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
So to get things started, we are incredibly honored to be joined by Dr. Mark Allen Derry. He is the founder of the New Orleans radio station 102.3 FM WHIV, which happens to be the first station that ever picked up Talk Poverty Radio. He's also a physician with the Tulane School of Medicine. Mark Allen, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we actually, dive into some of the questions that we have for you, given that you are in New Orleans and it's the 10th anniversary of Katrina, can you tell us a bit about WHIV and why you founded the station?
Sure. We founded the radio station as part of the low-power FM kind of movement that kind of went across the country last year, where the FCC opened up a bunch of new stations on the radio dial. I found out that New Orleans was qualified for one, and through my nonprofit, NOCETA, we were able to actually acquire the radio station. And we've been broadcasting since World AIDS Day, which was December 1st. And like I said, we are 102.3 WHIV. And the whole purpose of the radio station is really to kind of create programming that's dedicated to human rights and social justice. Now, I am an HIV physician, so I got to name the radio station. And I used HIV for kind of two reasons, WHIV for two reasons. One was to decrease the stigma associated with HIV. And if I can get people to go on air and say WHIV minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day, week after week, year after year, that's how you can destigmatize a stigma. But we also named it WHIV so that we are using the letters HIV as all things human rights and social justice. And so our programming and our music is dedicated to human rights and social justice. And that was kind of the whole concept for the radio station.
I'm speechless. I don't know how we follow that with anything.
No,
we're honored to be one of the shows that you broadcast, and we're really excited to have you on for this really important episode about the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Yes, thank you. And let me also say that WHIV is also very honored to be the first station to run your program. And as I've mentioned, I'm a huge fan, and so it's a real honor to be on. And it's an honor to be on for kind of what we're talking about, really, which is the 10th anniversary of Katrina. I mean, right now in New Orleans, it's pretty much all Katrina all the time. And a lot of the reason is that, as you guys saw, and I'm starting to get a little just kind of emotional even just starting to talk about it, as you guys saw what happened, it was a significantly and seriously traumatizing event, not only for the city and the psyche for the city, but also the people who experienced it, and of course the numbers of lives that were lost associated with that as well. And so it's with a lot of kind of weird, kind of emotional caution that people are approaching this 10th anniversary. And there are a lot of people who are leaving town, right? Folks that just don't want to kind of deal with it, I suppose. And there's a lot of people that are staying and that are kind of really trying to find different ways of honoring the event. And so there's lots of activities that are going to be happening on during the day. Of course, there's lots of civic or activities, the mayor, and apparently we're going to be visited by President Obama probably a day or two ahead of the event. So, I mean, you know, there is a lot of kind of respect that's being paid to the event, but it is done so with a strong emotional kind of pull with it as well.
And 10 years ago, you were preparing to move to New Orleans, actually, and then you found yourself heading up the health clinic for Katrina evacuees in the Astrodome in Houston. Can you, share with us what that experience was like and what led you actually to take that role?
Sure. So I'm an infectious diseases physician, so that's kind of what I do now. But at one point, I was doing emergency medicine, and I as I mentioned, I was in the process of moving to New Orleans during the summer of 2005. I was just finishing off my payback to the government as part of my med school kind of thing. And I was living on the Indian reservation, the Navajo reservation at the time. And so I was preparing to move, was here during the summer, found the place that I ultimately bought, and was kind of making the whole process of moving. And of course, Katrina happens, and the person I was working for at the time really felt that it was important for me to get to the Astrodome, where we had evacuees kind of being evacuated out of New Orleans too. And so it just turns out that, you know, that not only was I able to get into the Astrodome very easily, pretty much within like the, you know, 48 hours after the levees failed, what also happened was that it turns out that a previous medical director of one of the emergency medicine places that I had worked at was also in charge of that event. And so he basically plopped me right into the Astrodome as it was filling with the evacuees. And then I ran that medical clinic that was in that Astrodome from basically Katrina to Hurricane Rita. And then after that, everything kind of cleared after that. So it was with that kind of setting that then I kind of located to New Orleans, and to do so was really to kind of finish my training in infectious diseases at Tulane. And then I got kind of immediately kind of roped into, or not roped into, but, you know, got a job with Tulane immediately afterwards and have been here since then. And it was really interesting to be here from a medical provider perspective to kind of see how the city kind of recovered. And there was a lot of needs. There still is a lot of needs. But probably I think the biggest story from the healthcare perspective was the fact that our hospital, that was the hospital really for those that were low or no income. So basically a hospital for the poor, and in fact it was called Charity Hospital, was no longer. It was gone. And that was the hospital for New Orleans poor. And with that being gone, it created a huge vacuum, as you can imagine, within the healthcare system here in New Orleans. And from that, some good came in that we realized that as a healthcare system, we were relying on a centralized model of healthcare delivery. In other words, everything kind of happening through a hospital. And instead, we've kind of diversified a bit and start putting clinics into various neighborhoods so that it's, you know, it's not so centralized. We moved into that central model through Katrina and through the elimination of Charity. We kind of moved out into the communities and developed kind of more community centers. And that was a good thing. But it came at the cost of, you know, kind of the 5 to 6 years to develop that model and then actually implement it. There was a serious vacuum in that time, and that's just kind of a reality of one of the kind of the things that happened post Katrina. So
it sounds like there's been a lot of progress in many ways, but what do you think remains to be done to ensure that New Orleans is fully recovered? Because I know that a lot of people are still displaced from the Lower Ninth Ward. We hear that a lot of people can't return. What are the sorts of things, from your perspective, you think remain to be done for the city?
Well, so let me just say that's obviously it's an excellent question, and I'm going to first start by saying that's a little out of my kind of realm of, I'm not going to give you the best answers if I, you know, if we had a city planner here or somebody, but I can kind of give you my gut. And one thing that happened in New Orleans after obviously the storm was there was this real strong sense of we're going to renew New Orleans. In fact, that was just a t-shirt that was very well seen all over the city, renew New Orleans, or bumper sticker. And so one thing that you're going to see in the media over the course of, you know, the next couple of weeks as they focus on New Orleans, I think one theme that's going to come out very strong is this sense of there was this spirit of coming back, and we came back. I mean, that's what the Super Bowl win was, right? I mean, that's what, I mean, you know, to be at the lowest point of a city and then to be a few years later at the highest point of the city. I mean, just, you know, I live right outside the French Quarter, and just walking into the French Quarter, strangers were literally hugging one another. I hugged lots of people, and I'm not a hugger. You know? I mean, there was a lot of, you know, that spirit of, and it's silly. I mean, I you know, I'm not a sports fan. To live here, you have to be a Saints fan, so I've become a Saints fan, but, you know, that's the importance of a game, you know, of something like that. It embodied the kind of the spirit of us kind of winning the Super Bowl was a huge thing for us moving forward in terms of knowing that we can do this and we can do it together. And New Orleans is a great place. Love to have you guys come visit.
Well, we were just actually having a conversation about how we need to make it down to New Orleans and starting to look at some conferences that could be a good excuse to bring us down. So we will definitely let you know when our travel plans get solidified. But Mark Allendary, it is such an honor to have you on Talk Poverty Radio, and especially for this very important episode.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm now joined by Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League and former mayor of New Orleans. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you grew up in New Orleans, and I learned that your father was actually the first African-American mayor in New Orleans, and obviously you were a popular mayor in the 90s. So the city is part of your DNA. How was it witnessing your city at its lowest point?
It was difficult. It was troubling. I had, at that point in time, been out of office about 3 years and had moved to New York. So I was in New Orleans 2 days before Katrina hit for a funeral and flew out as people were evacuating. And when I turned on the television on Monday morning and Tuesday and saw the people at the convention center, which is incidentally named after my father, and the dome, suffering in the heat with no food, with no water, with no medical provisions, and with absent leadership, it was just not only heartbreaking, it was shocking, it brought me to tears, it made me angry. It's not describable when you see all of that human suffering, especially when you know it did not need to be that way.
And the National Urban League is actually hosting a conference about the 10th anniversary to evaluate the city's progress over the last decade. How do you personally view New Orleans' recovery?
I think that New Orleans' recovery deserves an I for incomplete. And that means there's been an enormous rebuilding effort. Public infrastructure, schools and bridges and parks. There's been an enormous effort by people to rebuild their homes all throughout the community. There's been, I think, a new level of civic engagement. But New Orleans' most difficult problems, like poverty, a racial income disparity and a racial wealth disparity, remain as they were at the time the hurricane hit, or in some cases worse. So the I really is to point out that this 10th year should be a commitment to a continuation. There's still neighborhoods, many of them historic African-American neighborhoods, which are far behind other parts of the community. There's still so much effort to be made to rebuild the community, to rebuild its economy, to deal with the challenges of poverty, the violence, and the need for police reform remain as acute today as they've ever been.
And I, you know, there's a couple articles that I've seen making its way around the web recently that almost romanticize some of the development that has occurred in the city. That you know, there's a rebirth in restaurants and this sort of thing. You know, basically describing a gentrification. You know, how do you reconcile?
Yeah, I push back vigorously against what I call a Chamber of Commerce spin approach, where you simply want to highlight, yes, there's some great new restaurants in New Orleans, and the restaurant scene is highly dynamic. Put a check on that. But New Orleans is working poor, who work in restaurants, who work in hotels, who make up beds, who provide the ground transportation, remain with stagnant wages, remain living below a basic decent minimum wage. So it's important as people look at this to realize that to paint with this brush that suggests that the city is far better off, that all things are great, is not accurate, nor is it true, nor does it do the city a good service. It does the city a disservice to suggest that. I think what is more important is to celebrate the power and the ingenuity and the drive of people who believe that New Orleans should have been rebuilt. Look, I was on a panel just the other evening, and someone asked me the same kind of question I got asked in October 2005. Why should we rebuild New Orleans if it is below sea level? Well, many coastal cities, San Francisco and Los Angeles, are on a fault. Tampa and Fort Lauderdale and Miami and Jacksonville and Charleston, for example, are cities at risk to a hurricane. Houston is at risk of flooding. If you apply that standard, then we should close shop in all of our coastal cities. No, New Orleans had to be rebuilt and must continue to be rebuilt because it is one of the world's great cities for its culture, for its music, and for its food. And I think what's important to say is the culture and the food help to bring the community back. And the reason why is because people recognize, I think, more than ever, when the city was almost completely destroyed by Katrina, that New Orleans culture is what made it unique. Its sense of multiculturalism, its music, its food, what it represents not only to Louisiana, but what it represents to the nation and the world.
And as you kind of mentioned, there's many cities across the country that face vulnerability. So as president of the National Urban League, you know, stepping back from Katrina a bit, you know, what do you think are the highest priorities for low-income urban areas just across the country?
I think it's jobs and education. I think that the job creation and pushing up wages. See, I think it's important not only to create jobs, but to create jobs and a climate where when people work, they can support themselves. When people work, they have basic human dignity. When people work, they can take care of their children and their families and their responsibilities. I think economic self-sufficiency, economic independence is what people want. And I think that's the challenge for low-income Americans across the board of all races, backgrounds, in all cities. We have got to address that. When you have lots of working poor, and the working poor are really the backbone of the New Orleans economy, there needs to be advocacy. And there was recently a 6-0 vote by the New Orleans City Council that will require vendors and contractors of the city to pay their employees a living wage. So you've got some enlightened public officials. Councilman Jared Brosset put together a coalition. The mayor signed it, which is an example of local public policy pushing for solutions to the wide gaps in income that we face in New Orleans and across the nation.
Another big issue that's being discussed in urban areas across the country is police brutality and racial justice. And at the National Urban League's conference, you had a presidential plenary that put these issues at the front and center. And, you know, I'm curious about your thoughts on how the Black Lives Matter movement is doing in regard to urban issues.
I mean, I think the Black Lives Matter movement is helping to elevate what many of us have been pushing and talking about for a long time, and which has really, really been stoked in the public consciousness with all of the high-profile incidents, whether it's Trayvon Martin, that tragedy, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, and I could name many, many others, African-Americans who have been severely injured or lost their lives due to excessive use of force by law enforcement. This is an issue that candidates for president will have to confront. Maybe for the Democratic candidates, it's more in the primary, but certainly for the Republican candidates, if it's not in the primary, it will be in the general election. When there's distrust in the issue, you've got to build trust and a working relationship. And I would hold up what I was able to do when I was mayor of New Orleans, when we had a historic police reform effort, which built strong bridges with the community. We significantly reduced police misconduct and brutality, while at the same time reducing violence and crime. There's all too often a false choice that people feel they need to make. Either we have to have tough police, and with that goes bad community relations, or we have to have the alternative. I say that our goal as a country and a nation is to have effective, respectful policing. Policing that keeps communities safe and works with communities at the same time. And I think it's possible. I think it's done. The 1990s example of New Orleans is but one. There are others around the country. And I think people need to lift up the success stories to demonstrate that we can bring about the kind of change. But it's a systematic problem in this country. It does not help race relations. It does not lower the crime rate. And it's corrosive to the sense of community at every level.
And since we were talking a bit about the presidential campaign, before I let you go, I'd just be curious, you know, what you hope the next president of the United States, regardless of who he or she may be, will focus on with regard to urban America.
I hope they'll focus on education, jobs, and justice. And I hope that they will seriously make confronting the challenges of urban America central to their domestic policy. Central to it, not a sideline, not something that's just over at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, but which is what is part of everything we do. Cities, metropolitan cities. And today, when we look at cities, we're not just talking about the central city. You're also talking about suburban communities that are now more urban, that have small towns and villages and cities located within them. Look at metropolitan Philadelphia or metropolitan Washington or metropolitan New York or Cleveland or Chicago or New Orleans or Atlanta. Their suburbs are urban. They are multi-ethnic. They have large communities of people of color. They have many of the challenges of schools and crime and crumbling infrastructure that cities have. It's a chance for a new president to build a governing coalition around the metropolitan America, around cities as really the key to our success and our futures. It was cities that drove the Industrial Revolution, and I think it must be cities that drive the 21st century.
Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League and former mayor of New Orleans, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and stay in touch.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. On August 29th, 2005, when Hurricane Katrina slammed into the coast, more than 50 levees and flood walls built to protect New Orleans failed. To discuss this man-made disaster, I'm joined by activist Sandy Rosenthal, founder and executive director of levees.org. Welcome to the program, Sandy.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the mission of your organization is to educate the public about the facts that occurred around the flooding after Hurricane Katrina. And,
yes.
And I imagine that there were a number of issues that you could focus on, but what made you want to focus in on the levees in particular?
What probably brought me to that focus was an argument I had with a gentleman from North Louisiana who actually blamed me and people like me for living in the city of New Orleans. He said we shouldn't have been living there and that more storms will come and it's our fault that this happened. And I think that's what drove me to focus on the proven causes of the flood instead of the imaginary ones.
And we hear that a lot, actually, in recovery. You know, I focus a lot on climate resilience in the work that I do. And, you know, I've heard people say, well, should we even be rebuilding in floodplains? You know, what do you think about that?
Well, 39 of 50 cities are on, at least partly, on a floodplain. People build by water for navigation, irrigation, and aesthetics. People like to be near the water. So that's really not a reasonable thing to do or to say.
So take me back 10 years ago. So obviously this man that spurred you to create this organization didn't go through the same experience that you did. Can you tell us what that was like?
Well, we did evacuate. My husband had been here for Hurricane Betsy 40 years earlier, and he knew that there would be no electricity for at least a month, and probably no phones for longer. So we packed up, we boarded up the house, packed up and left. And so we watched all of destruction from afar, from the city of Jackson, Mississippi. But unless you've been through it, it's really difficult to understand because you lose all your support bases. It's not just your house, it's your business, your school, the post office, where you buy food, your church. It's everything. And it's hard to imagine the scope of the of living through such a disaster.
And so you created Levees.org just a few months after this occurred. And what was it like to start this organization? Were people on the same page as you about this?
Well, in the beginning, if you recall, there was a fairy tale had took flight about what caused the flooding, a fairy tale of a monster storm in a city below the sea and local corruption. And it was also easy to believe. I mean, how could this possibly be the fault of the organization that built the levees, the Army Corps of Engineers? They had a sterling reputation with two centuries of experience. And this is the organization that had, before Katrina, previously built tens of thousands of miles of levees along the Mississippi, Missouri, and Ohio rivers. And those never break. So I forgive everybody for believing the fairy tale. But eventually, the studies, one by one, pointed to tragic mistakes by the Army Corps, most recently reconfirmed again in another new study just released 2 weeks ago. Lead author J. David Rogers wrote an article that appeared in Water Policy, the official journal of the World Water Council.
And so what are the goals of your organization today?
Well, over 10 years, the goals have changed. Initially, we tried to pass federal legislation based on lessons learned. We tried to pass reform of the Army Corps of Engineers, which did pass, and we focused on passing a more fair rule on revenue from royalties from offshore drilling. Before Katrina, the state of Louisiana only got 0.5% of the revenues. And to put it in perspective, Texas gets 50%. And we also pushed for an independent commission on figuring out why the levees failed. And that did not pass, but the studies that were done, because we focused so much attention on the fact that we needed an independent commission, we think the studies that were done quite well, and we're actually satisfied with those. But more recently, to answer your question, we've been focused on putting historic plaques at breach sites. These are vetted and fact-checked by the Louisiana State Office of Historic Preservation. And we're focused on putting one of the levee breaches, one of the more catastrophic ones, on the National Register of Historic Places. But what we're most excited about is our recently opened levee exhibit hall in Rain Garden. This exhibit hall is an outdoor museum that explains all the breaches, all the neighborhoods, and all the lives.
And what are you hoping that people gain from this? Because I was on your website earlier, and I saw that you do tours of the various points of the breaches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of me was thinking, well, could this be construed as disaster tourism?
That's interesting that you say that. In fact, the neighbors that live near the levee exhibit hall in Rain Garden love the fact that they have a park there. They come out and they water the plants. There's a Mardi Gras Indian chief who lives across the street. He comes on Sunday with his kids to water the plants, and they actually love to see the tour buses come. This is they understand that too many people still believe the fairy tale, and this is one way that Americans can find out the true reason that New Orleans flooded. I don't know if I mentioned yet, but 55% of the American population lives in counties protected by levees. So this is truly a national issue.
And that leads a bit into my next question, because your activism is bigger than just one city, as it's spilled into other communities and states. I know that there's levees.org kind of chapters. You know, what is it that you think that state and federal leaders should be doing to ensure another Katrina doesn't happen?
Well, here in New Orleans after Katrina, when Mayor Landry was elected mayor, I served on his transition team, and we recommended creating a brand new position within city government that will monitor and focus on coastal restoration and flood protection. And the mayor did create this position, and the position was filled by a gentleman from the Lower Ninth Ward named Charles Allen. So this is something that probably should be done in all of those states that have cities living on floodplains.
And to just back up a bit from all of this, you know, how in your view has New Orleans as a city changed in the past 10 years, and what work do you think remains for the city?
Okay, well, for those who could come back, the city's much better. We now have a $14.5 billion levee protection, which we should have had before Katrina, but better late than never. The education system, the public education, the schools are much better, not a little better, way better. And if you were able to come home, you would find that with our checkerboard neighborhood, we tended to be black neighborhoods, white neighborhoods that were kind of separated from each other. But now there's been reaching across, hands reaching across neighborhoods. The city is more racially working together. However, if you couldn't return, it's terrible. And there are so many people that all their assets was in their home. And when they lost their entire home, they couldn't return. And for them, New Orleans is not a better place.
People, I think, tend to think of the lower Ninth Ward when they think about Hurricane Katrina. And I know that about 37% of the population in the lower Ninth Ward was unable to return, kind of as you're, you know, alluding to. You know, what is occurring around the lower Ninth Ward?
Well, the lower Ninth Ward, there's no doubt about it, has been the slowest to return to its former self. This can be attributed to several things. One of them is the pure devastation. I mean, in the case of the lower Ninth Ward, it was devastated by the rupture of a navigation channel big enough for ships.
Mm-hmm.
So the sheer scope of the disaster is a factor. But another factor is there was no place for this community to take root right after the flooding because all the neighborhoods all around also flooded. And then the third thing is it was more, even though it was mainly homeowners, it was lower to middle-class homeowners. And there was just a situation where they just didn't have the assets and the bank account to be able to come back. So it's a triple whammy for the lower Ninth Ward. And I am very glad that philanthropists and volunteers have come to the lower Ninth Ward in droves because they do need it. There's no question.
Sure. And what do you hope to do for levees.org moving forward?
One of the problems with our organization is, and I knew this from the start, is how do we measure success? How do we know we've won? But the signs are there. One of the big reasons we know it we are getting there is the national media outlets have stopped using terminology like Katrina flooded New Orleans, which is really simply lazy. To say Katrina flooded New Orleans would be like saying an iceberg killed all those people on the Titanic. Katrina, like the iceberg, exposed human mistakes. An iceberg exposed that a ship was trying to cross the Atlantic with too few lifeboats. And in the case of Katrina, the storm surge exposed human beings' mistakes in the levees. But we have made enormous strides, and I'm pleased to say that I can see in the near future that I may be looking to do something new.
Sandy Rosenthal, founder and executive director of levees.org. Thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And my guest is Danielle Bosson. She's the Managing Director of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. Danielle, welcome to Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
So the Katrina exodus was the largest forced migration of people in the United States due to a climate event since the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. And you recently wrote a column titled, When You Can't Go Home, The Gulf Coast 10 Years After Katrina. Now, 10 years later, do we know where the residents of the Gulf Coast are?
Well, we don't know where most of them are. So we know that, as you mentioned, about 1.5 million people were displaced throughout the Gulf Coast region. We know that after the storm, about 250,000 people went to Houston, population of Baton Rouge doubled, and 100,000 people went to Atlanta. But we don't have very good data on where the rest of that 1.5 million people went, and we don't know how many of them were really able to return. We've got some statistics that show that 3 years later, about 60% of residents had returned to their homes, but where that other 40% remained and remains today is still a mystery for a lot of people, including myself.
You write in that piece that evidence indicates that the climate displaced, and particularly those who are low income, can suffer from greater hardships than they did prior to evacuation. Why is that the case?
Well, in part, it's because people in low-income communities were suffering greater hardship before the extreme weather event like Katrina happened in the first place. And then we've seen that after any extreme weather event, not just Hurricane Katrina, but after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of physical damage to homes. People who lacked insurance, people who were renting, lacked renter's insurance, or who just simply saw the apartments that they lived in disappear underwater, didn't have the ability to go back home. And then in addition, there's also an economic toll that happens to low-income people after an extreme weather event, particularly for people who have wage-based jobs. It becomes very difficult to get to work if your place of work still exists. And then if you are forced to move somewhere else, then it becomes difficult to find employment. You might be in a saturated market and not be able to get back on your feet as quickly as somebody who has connections or savings or resources that many people in low-income communities lack.
Now, on the flip side, sometimes we hear a narrative, and actually this was a narrative that was sort of front and center in a New Yorker piece that is being widely shared by Malcolm Gladwell about Katrina 10 years on. And that narrative sort of says, well, a lot of people are doing a heck of a lot better since they got displaced. Maybe Katrina was a good thing. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think we're all looking for silver linings, and we're all looking to find the good things that could have occurred after a devastating event like Hurricane Katrina or after any devastating extreme weather event. But the fact is that there may be some people who were able to move into neighborhoods that had better markers for economic mobility. It's unclear whether everybody who moved into so-called better neighborhoods were able to prosper like their neighbors were. It's unclear whether people who left home and found themselves somewhere new wanted to be somewhere new or found themselves thrust there. And so I think we need to celebrate the successes that have come out of Katrina, but not forget that there are many people who are still struggling today and continue to struggle, not just after Hurricane Katrina, but after Hurricane Sandy and after a number of other extreme weather events like wildfires and river floodings that have forced people from their homes and left them unable to return or, if not to their home, then even to the neighborhoods that they know and love.
So massive weather events that force people to leave, maybe not necessarily the prescription for low-income communities?
I would not say that. I think I certainly don't want to force people to live where they don't want to live, but I also don't want to force them to leave places that they want to be in.
So what can be done to prevent low-income communities from being displaced by these kinds of extreme weather events? And if and when people are displaced, how can policymakers best support them?
Well, the first thing that I would recommend is preventing displacement in the first place by having a strong climate resilience city and community to start with. So in other words, if you reduce the chance of flooding or fire or whatever the natural disaster is, then you reduce the chances of people having to leave their homes. And what we've seen is that there's a way of doing that focuses on the hard infrastructure, so things like levees or sandbars or other physical structures. And then there's also this approach for soft infrastructure, what I call social cohesion, which is building your resilience in a way that doesn't just protect the homes, but protects communities at large. We've seen a lot of climate resilience planners who are doing great work and focusing on how to stop the physical impacts of the storm, but there is this social network impact that often gets overlooked. So when people are planning where they're going to be dividing communities or building walls or moving people, doing that in a way that understands how communities, and particularly low-income communities, because of their vulnerability to extreme weather events, understanding how those physical changes will impact the social networks of a community is a very important tool in preventing that climate displacement. And once people are displaced, you know, I think the challenge has been for many cities is how to deal with issues of massive evacuations or massive influxes of people as they happen. And so both the federal government, local government, and state governments really, I think, would do themselves a good bit of service by studying how they can accommodate displaced people before an event occurs.
Well, and you brought up that buzzword, social cohesion. I know this is something that you've done a lot of work on. Katrina is not the only anniversary that we're commemorating this year. We're also commemorating another major anniversary of a deadly extreme weather event, which was that 20 years ago, Chicago was hit by a heat wave that resulted in 465 deaths, perhaps getting a little bit less attention than Katrina, but important and worth noting as well. And you wrote a recent report that discussed that heat wave and showed that social cohesion, which you've talked about now, made a life-saving difference for some communities that were impacted.
That's right. So it was 20 years ago this July, Chicago's deadliest weather event so far, and hopefully ever, was this devastating heat wave. And sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg, apologies if I'm pronouncing his last name incorrectly, I have not met him, but wrote a really wonderful book and has done some extensive research where he looked at that heat wave and discovered that, you know, yes, a lot of the communities that were negatively impacted were low-income communities that were often communities of color that had high rates of violence, but that those communities were also the same markers for communities that did very well during, and when I mean did very well, I mean survived the heat wave. Mm-hmm. And so when he started to look at, you know, well, why is it that this community fared so poorly and this community did so well when they both were low-income? He found that there were markers of this social cohesion. So places where people congregated, where they knew their neighbors, where they did their shopping locally, enabled them to be on the lookout for each other. What I did in the column was extrapolate from that and look at things like Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy and try to look for these markers and say, you know, there are examples of where people who live in more cohesive communities, not necessarily higher income, but more cohesive communities have better chances of surviving an extreme weather event, being able to evacuate safely, but then also trying to band together to get the most out of government and other resources available to them after an extreme weather event.
So it isn't just how much money is in a community, it's also actually that social cohesion factor.
Absolutely. I think one of the striking things that you hear about with regard to Katrina victims is people talking about how much they miss home and how much, even when they do move back, the loss of the rest of that community, what that means to them. People talk about, you know, how they, and I'm not citing any specific person, but there are numerous news reports that have quotes from people who talk about, well, we used to have, you know, neighborhood cookouts here, or we used to play music here, but now we need a permit. And the people who live in this neighborhood don't understand the history anymore and don't understand why we want to get together and how we all knew each other. And those things may seem minor to people who don't understand those communities or don't live in those kinds of tight-knit communities, but it's incredibly important for any kind of community, not just a low-income community.
So what can policymakers and government leaders do to foster and encourage social cohesion in communities?
So this is tricky, and I'm not going to say that there's some sort of silver bullet here that can foster community cohesion, but there are some government programs where that have been trying to encourage this. The city of Baltimore comes to mind. They have a program. This is specifically targeted toward extreme weather, things like heat waves, where it's as simple as giving residents placards that they can put in their windows that say, I'm okay, or I need help. And this can help people who have mobility problems or language barriers or, you know, just don't really know anybody in their neighborhood anymore or are new to a neighborhood, to say, you know, please call the police. Please help me. I need help. I can't survive right now. Then there's also, frankly, just support for the existing social organizations that exist. So we saw during Hurricane Katrina that a lot of places of religious worship came forward and said, we want to help provide shelter. We want to help provide food. We want to be a part of the solution. after Hurricane Sandy, there were even it's coming to mind now. It was a Boys and Girls Club, I believe, that got together and said, all right, we're going to be a resource. We're going to go door to door in a neighborhood where people know us and trust us. We're going to say, what do you need? How can we help you? And then relay that information to government leaders to try to get that help. I think having that connection between, you know, a sort of faceless government organization and people in the community who understand what's happening, where people are most vulnerable, how to get them help. This is actually doing good on the ground. This is helping people who have been historically usually ignored or disparaged by communities to have a bridge and be able to foster a dialogue that enables a stronger community and a stronger connection.
And perhaps more important and even more challenging than ever, given the breakdown in relations between communities and government, particularly police. Danielle Bosson is the Managing Director of Energy Policy here at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much, Danielle.
Thank you.
Last week, I was invited to join the Bill Press Show as a guest to discuss a recent article I wrote on Medium entitled Remembering Katrina in the Black Lives Matter Movement. Take a listen.
I am your guest host, Charles Ellison, at Ellison Report as well. And we've got Tracy Ross now.
Thank you.
All right. We've been talking about you like from the previous hour. We were like setting it up.
I know. I was
like,
sitting in the hallway. I could hear my name.
Yeah. That's right. Tracy Ross. That's right.
You're not in trouble.
That's right. Tracy Ross. Come on. Right. So, at Tracy L. Ross.
Yes. With an E.
Tracy with an E. Tracy okay. With an E.
Yes. All right. Otherwise, it would be tracky. That's why I tell people, they're like, why do you have an extra letter?
Don't do tracky. Yeah. Don't do tracky. Right. But you can track her down at Tracy L. Ross. She is the associate director of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org is the website. Doing some great, fantastic work over there. So the reason I brought you in is because I had actually sourced you for a piece that I wrote earlier this week in TheRoot.com about environmental racism. Racism in the air you breathe, that is the title of it. And it kind of created a firestorm of discussion, which is good. That's what we want.
Absolutely.
So, and let's talk a little bit about that, about environmental racism, about that issue, because it's a very important issue, but we're not talking enough about it. I mean, well, first of all, let's get into how important is environmental racism, because we had a lot of discussion over the past year about Black Lives Matter and about how people of color are impacted by like racist violence. But there's something really exceptionally violent about environmental racism.
Sure. I think we should talk, step back and define it a little bit, because I think people hear environmental racism and probably already are like, well, how is that? Like, how is that possible?
Right.
What does that mean? How can the environment discriminate against people? And,
exactly.
And really what it comes down to is how we situate people in our communities,
mm-hmm.
that African Americans in particular are disproportionately living in places that are harmful to their health, and that's by design. We have, you know, a history of policies in this country that have made it so that the federal government has invested in the stability and strength of affluent white communities while pushing low income and African American and other communities of color into places that are hazardous for their health. So, for instance, you know, African Americans disproportionately live near highways, disproportionately live near oil refineries, waste facilities. So even the title of your piece was spot on, because people of color are likely to inhale 38% more pollution than white people. And that's why we see, you know, higher asthma rates amongst black children. And so it really is about the way that we have engineered our communities to disproportionately harm people of color.
And how did that happen? I mean, have we looked at how that happened? Like how, like so many highways were built near black neighborhoods or communities of color? They end up like near airports and oil refineries?
Have we
looked at, how did all that kind of happen? And how long has it been going on?
Sure. Well, I would say, you know, beginning in the 1930s, you have the practice of redlining. So that made it so that the best communities, you know, African Americans could not access home loans or move into these communities. And so the federal government, like I was saying, invested in white communities and in giving access to loans and being able to allow people to move out to the suburbs who are white at the same time that they allowed localities to have the autonomy to basically move African Americans around however they wanted. So it might have been like, we're going to build housing projects in, you know, a poor part of town. We, as we're, you know, expanding the highway system during the 1950s, the highways, you know, there's more, you have more political power and more cachet when you're wealthier and when you are white in this country, especially in the 1950s. So when the highway expansion was going on, you know, you could fight back against a highway coming into a nice neighborhood that's filled with, you know, white people. But there were plenty of businesses that African Americans owned, homes, all of these things that were essentially destroyed to have the highway system that we have today.
Interesting. Talking with Tracy Ross, she is Associate Director of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at Center for American Progress. Go to AmericanProgress.org for more information. At Tracy with an E, L. Ross on Twitter. You can kind of keep up with what she's doing. We're talking about environmental racism today here on the Bill Press Show. I'm your guest host, Charles Ellison. Also sitting in the studio with me is Peter Ogburn. You see Peter all the time, every day. So I don't even need to like say it's Peter Ogburn is in here. So, you know, I'm just giving you props. But
I'm just letting y'all do your thing. The last thing I'm going to do is get involved in this, right?
Like, so, Peter, have you been living near smokestacks?
Look, guys, the struggle is real.
So we this is ongoing. We've been talking about this, like, often on the show, talking about this whole Sean King controversy.
But this, but this, I think, is a really interesting topic to talk about because this gets back to something we were talking about earlier on the show about racism and what the president said when he was on that podcast. Is he said, you know, racism isn't someone coming up and calling you the N-word.
Right.
That exists.
Yeah.
But and a lot of people are going to face that and have to deal with that. But that's not the kind of racism that we're talking about.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's stuff like this that people don't necessarily equate with racism. But if you really look at it, it's there.
Absolutely.
And that's a very good point. I mean, and Tracy, speak to that as far as like, okay, so the branding of environmental racism or how people are aware of it or what people, you know, we just went into the definition of it. There's probably a lot of listeners out there that did, oh, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, or, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, I went to my black friend's house the other day and it was like a highway right there. You know, I mean but talk about how confused the public might be about environmental racism.
Right. And I think Peter's point was exactly right because I think we like to think of racism as the boogeyman, so we can all be like, "Yeah, I'm against that. Exactly. I'm against the N-word."
I'm not racist. I've never called someone the N-word.
And part of that,
you know, we're like Louis C.K. now. You know that Louis C.K. bit about the N-word, because we're thinking it
now. Like, now you're saying forcing N-word? Me to think it, Peter. You're putting it in my brain. Peter. Thanks a lot.
Sorry, white guy faux pas.
But I think, you know, with structural racism, people don't like talking about that because then that means we're all complacent in something. You know, I want to feel like a good person, but, you know, I feel like the average white family who lives in a nice neighborhood, that's not really their fault. You know, they're just trying to live in a place that's good and healthy for their family. So I think that if I'm talking about environmental racism, I wouldn't want, you know, a white family to think that they're doing something wrong. Right. I want to live in a nice neighborhood too, you know? So it's that we've created systems and institutions that need to be changed. So, you know, I'm not for pushing out white families out of the suburbs.
You know, there was that other discussion too. And I talked to Robert Bullard, who's considered like the grandfather, godfather of environmental justice. You know, some people kind of say he spawned this environmental justice movement in the 80s. And he was making the point, he was very emphatic about this when I talked to him earlier for the piece. He was like, it's not about class, it's about race. Because he was saying, and I think you were saying too, you know, where it's like, yeah, you could even get middle class black families still living in a situation like that. I got some personal experience with that as well. So they could be making like 50, 60 grand a year, black family, still live next to the oil refinery.
Absolutely.
And I mean, speak on that.
Yeah. So you know, the sorts of policies that I described happening in the 30s and the 50s, you know, now that we ended, you know, redlining. Well,
legal segregation.
Right, right. It doesn't mean that everything all of a sudden we integrated all of these neighborhoods.
Right, right.
And so you still have the black families that were living in the worst neighborhoods are going to pass on their homes, if they're lucky enough to have one, to their children. And we know that 70% of all people that black people that live in the worst neighborhoods are the children and grandchildren of those that lived in similar neighborhoods, you know, 50 years ago. I was going to say my favorite sociologist. You know, every girl has a favorite sociologist, but Patrick Sharkey at NYU.
Okay.
He's done amazing research on this, and he's he found that the average African American family making $100,000 a year lives in a more disadvantaged neighborhood than the average white family making $30,000 a year. And I think that that just shows how poverty and racism is multi-generational.
That's stunning.
And actually, half of all black families in the country at some point in their lives have lived in the worst neighborhoods, and that's only true for about 7% of white people.
Interesting. We're talking with Tracy L. Ross at Tracy L. Ross, and also Tracy, as far as, you know, going back to that, I wish we had, how much more time do we have, man? This is a fascinating.
You got a break. You got like 4 more minutes before a break. Yeah. You can keep rolling.
Okay, and thank you. Here at the Bill Press Show, BillPressShow.com.
One of my many talents.
Yeah, it's good to know. There's a lot to talk about with respect to the issue. And so, you know, going back to that awareness, that branding, I mean, is it, you know, whose fault is that? I mean, how come, because this is like a big, massive Grim Reaper that's like wrapped around like entire communities of color. Like I saw somewhere, I think it was the NAACP report that came out a couple of years ago about the impact of environmental racism, about coal mining operations, and like the 12 of the top 20 worst coal mining or coal producing plants are near communities of color, near black communities. Like the majority of people that live near those plants are people of color, black people. And it's like, wow, you know, I didn't realize how that. So it's apparently, it's like, if you could do a comparison between like environmental racism and like killings from like corrupt racist white cops, like there's more people dying from environmental racism.
Sure.
But and not to make that comparison, but I mean, whose fault is that? That branding? I mean, is it the activist? I mean, is it mainstream media? Is it the public? Because they're like more interested in, you know, seeing Kim Kardashian in like a thousand different angles.
Right.
I mean, what is that?
Well,
it's
definitely not the activists' fault.
Right.
I think that there's fortunately a lot of people on the ground doing some good work. You know, I think placing blame is always complicated, but I think that it is incumbent upon the government to hold these sorts of, you know, oil refineries and companies and all that accountable. So I know actually, and this is probably a good example of these two groups I'm talking about, but in I think it was last year, some environmental groups filed a lawsuit on behalf of families in Texas, California, and Louisiana, families that lived near an oil refinery, and they filed suit, and it forced the EPA to basically create new regulations on what oil companies are refineries, how much pollution they're allowed to emit. But part of that, you know, it'll require the EPA holding, you know, those oil refineries accountable because, you know, they'll pollute regardless. So I think that's a good example of that. There are people on the ground who are unsung heroes who are doing important work. Luckily, you know, that story, I first came across it in an NPR story, but, you know, I think radio and print will do a pretty good job, but a lot of people are watching television. You don't really see these sorts of stories in the media. So I think you're right to bring up the media. I think they need to be more invested in this issue, but it's going to come down to, you know, the government and the companies themselves.
And there's a larger issue of like climate change and how, like, you had said this, and I quoted you about how there's this assumption that like natural disasters, like those wildfires or like what happened with Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. I did want to get to that because you wrote this very eloquent piece about, you know, the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and aligning that with the Black Lives Matter movement. But you were saying that natural disasters are not the big equalizer the way we see them.
Right.
Explain that.
Right, yeah. So I think we see them as these equal opportunity forces of destruction that, you know, we're all in this together, we're all going to get hit.
Right.
And I don't want to dismiss the tragedies that a lot of families, a lot of white families, are still dealing with the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy, you know, from 2012. So they do reap havoc on a lot of families, but the fact of the matter is that extreme weather events exacerbate the underlying, you know, socioeconomic problems that we experience year round.
Right.
So if you're poor, you're going to be driven deeper into poverty. Yeah. If you're disabled, you're going to have a hard time, you know, evacuating or whatever the circumstances might be. Okay. So it really just does take your station in life and really hammer you into that place.
Got it. Oh, wow. Talking to Tracy Ross, Associate Director of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, at Tracy with an E-L Ross. You can also go to AmericanProgress.org for more information. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Of course. No problem.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast.
You can also find us on the Progressive Voices Network at 10 a.m. East, 7 a.m. West, using the TuneIn app.